Hello, my marketing and entrepreneur friends. Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Let's Talk Marketing Podcast. I am your host, Katya Allison. So what have you gotten yourself into? Together, we are decoding marketing to make it accessible for everyone. Cut through the BS and get down to the nitty-gritty. And in each episode, you're going to walk away with a nugget or an insight that you can bring into your professional and sometimes, dare I say, even personal life. So stick around and take a listen to all of the knowledge bombs that are being dropped in every episode. Today, my guest is Ethan Monkhouse, who is the president and the CTO of Naviro. And we're talking all about what it really takes to turn attention into action. Ethan is a behavioral systems strategist, an AI builder, and the kind of person who sees human behavior as data waiting to be decoded. He's worked on marketing systems for global brands like Lexus and UBS, but now he's helping creators and founders grow revenue by identifying that 10% of their audience that actually moves the needle, often before they even hit follow. We talk about why marketers are chasing the wrong metrics, how intent matters more than impressions, and how a small tweak in how you ask for engagement can lead to 30 to 40 times better results. He shares an incredible example involving a music release campaign that went from flat to phenomenal, all by shifting focus from a passive attention to active curiosity. So if you're tired of chasing vanity metrics, and I know you are, if you're ready to understand the real ROI of your content, or if you just want to nerd out on the intersection of psychology, tech, and marketing, this is your episode. So grab your favorite beverage, sit back, and let's dive into it. Let's talk marketing. Ethan, welcome to the Let's Talk Marketing Podcast. Very excited to have you on here today to dive into just kind of creator economy and AI. So welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're going to start off with the easy questions, and that's getting to know you a little bit. Now, typically I ask, what was your first marketing role? But I don't really feel like that hat suits your head. So I'm going to ask you, like, sort of where you got started in this entrepreneur AI area.
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of fell into marketing by nature of what I did. So I think I was about probably 15, and I grew up in a really small town in Ireland and realized that there were all these businesses who barely had a website. And so what I did was I built them all websites for free, didn't charge anything, but I did know in the back of my head that eventually they're going to need things to go on their website. And that's where we started with the marketing. So they all had their websites. They were so happy. This 15-year-old had built it for free. And then they were like, well, can we put some footage up? And I was like, oh, I actually have a camera. And that's when we started building out promotional videos. And that went from restaurants to little shops on the corner, all the way to like surf schools. And after that, it just kind of snowballed into, oh, wait, we can do this as a job. This is a nice little part-time job as we went through high school. And so kept on doing that. And that eventually moved into the world of advertising online. And this is when Google Ads and Facebook Ads were just beginning, or really starting to get traction and very different to what they are now. And that's why I started off marketing campaigns. And that eventually snowballed into, hey, wait, we're pretty good at this. Let's see how we can automate it. And we did that way before ChatGPT, any sort of mention of AI. And when AI came along, it almost supercharged the whole process. And that's just brought us to where we are today, which is, well, Naviro is my latest venture. And my entire life revolves around it, but I absolutely love it.
Well, that's the nature of the beast when it comes to startups, and especially in software in this kind of area that you're in. What about it do you love? But be prepared, because I also want to know, if I had a magic wand, what could I take away? So let's start with the good. What is it that you love about what you're currently doing?
It's understanding patterns is what fascinates me, and the patterns that people don't see. That's what, up until 3 years ago, it was almost impossible to pick up on these patterns. Yet with AI and all this exponential advancement in technology, you can now pick up on patterns that we didn't even realize that we left those signals to even be realized. So that for me is what keeps me so energized with what I do. Is I, like a lot of people, just see an ad campaign, I see it as a massive collection of human behavior to analyze, and then all the signals to pick up from that. And what's that going to mean? What are you going to do because you know that?
Ooh, I like that. Now, what, remember, I have my magic wand. What can I take away
from that? I mean, it all comes down to attention. In my, like, I'm a big fan of like attention economics, and a lot of people, and you hear left, right, and center, you have 3 seconds to capture people's attention.
Yeah.
Through all content. Attention isn't really what we should be trying to do. It should be, we're trying to capture intent, because attention is quite passive, whilst intent is directional. And that's why you see like that a lot of people are saying that it's the return of low ticket offers. You have a lot of low tickets coming back into the market, which was really interesting because you thought those had actually been phased out. But there's a bit more to it where it isn't just a, say, a $29 product you're buying. You're buying and confirming intent there with the customer. And at the end of the day, it's a lot better to validate it from a low ticket, knowing that they're leaning in to what your story is and what your narrative is, rather than looking at a metric and thinking, oh, they liked it, they might be interested. So it's all very different nowadays. I think it is, there's too much focus on capturing attention when it really is capturing intent.
I want to unpack that actually just a little bit more, because I heard what you said, but I don't know how to take action on something like that. I of course, am a marketer who does want attention. Not in general and like for myself, but obviously everything that I do from a campaign perspective, the intent is to capture your attention, but based on what your intention is, which seems like we're saying the same thing, but we're saying two very different things, because when you're articulating it, it sounds like two separate buckets, but don't they work one in the same together?
They are part of the same, I guess, funnel, but
yeah.
One is top of funnel and one moves you far further down the funnel much quicker. Like, for example, we had a client we were working with, and this is just a quick example of like where I saw intent foster so quickly, was they were pushing out a new release and couldn't get engagement up. They were like, okay, yeah, we're getting a load of impressions, but people just aren't engaging. And the way of activating that follower base, which was around 110K at the time, was quite ambiguous, because it was very easy to get a lot of views on your story or a lot of reactions or a lot of comments. But when it came to actually taking that action, it got a bit more complicated. Mm-hmm. So what we did was we put up on our story, I'm about to release. So there was a music release coming out just before that as well. And he was going to put it up on story, and he was going to say, oh, guys, I've been working on this behind the scenes. What do you think? And giving the snippet of music he was working on. And instead of doing that, we said, put up a story and say, hey, guys, I've been working on something behind the scenes. Not too sure what you guys are going to think of it. DM me and I'll send it to you. And there's like three parts to that. It's one, it's you're sparking curiosity, but then also you're fostering this need to give their opinion. And then you're closing that off with action. And so his DMs just got flooded with people wanting to hear the song. And we just set up a quick ad automation with ManyChat, happy days, sent out the song. But then we took it another step further, because what I was saying about leaning in and that low ticket offer, that in a way was the low ticket offer. But we now had a massive list of people we knew lent in. And so what we did was we took that list and we added them all to the close friend story of that account, which not a lot of people actually do, even though it's such an obvious way of collecting your, not super fans, but your active fans. A lot of people set up Instagram broadcast channels, things like that. For me, whenever I follow someone and I get invited to a broadcast channel within 5 minutes of following them, I'm like, I'm not your fan yet. it's just the wrong time. And by doing this, a lot of people are like, whoa, I'm on X's close friend story. This is really cool. I feel really exclusive. And
yeah,
what that ended up doing was his engagement shot through the roof, because it wasn't just a collection of people who were so engaged with his content and leaning in so far. They also wanted to engage more because they were like, oh, I'm on this list. Not everyone is on this close friend story. I need to make sure I stay on this list. And ever since then, his engagement has just consistently been 30 to 40 times. Like when I say 30 to 40 times, I mean 30 to 40 times more of those actual valuable metrics. In the sense, well, we'll go into vanity metrics in a bit, but higher than what it was before. And it was all just from that small shift in just changing the optics slightly.
Yeah. What I hear you saying is that there is a lot of psychology into what it is that you're doing, because in the same way that storytelling is what we should be doing and what we should be crafting with every kind of campaign and message that we send out, because it aligns with someone's emotions. To me, it sounds like that's what you're doing. There's a lot of psychology of like this exclusive, because that is something, right? Like, oh, I'm special. Like that's an emotion that you're tapping into that drives action. And you know, what you've crafted is this list of people, like you said, that have a higher intent, and that intent leads to like the conversion for them to take action into, I don't know, I'm assuming downloading the song.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is ultimately what you want.
Yeah.
Now, in this area that you're in, from just what you're doing with AI, I imagine, especially now, that you kind of have to always be ahead of the curve on like what's going on. So how do you stay ahead of the curve? How do you know, like, is it just pure experimentation? Are you like listening to someone? How do you stay ahead of the curve?
I think before it was almost an addiction to the industry, in the sense where we were always online. We always used the term chronically online, which I haven't really figured out if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but we knew exactly what was going on in every aspect of the industry. And then we realized, as the company scaled up, that, hey, it's not really possible for us to constantly checking all these news feeds, constantly being up to date with what's going on Reddit, what's going on Twitter, what are people talking about in the forums. And that's when my love for automation came into play. So like, anything I can automate, I will automate, in the sense where if it happens more than once, it needs to be automated. And before, it was this cost benefit of how much time is it going to take to automate versus how long am I going to be using it for?
Yeah.
That's been completely eliminated in the last year, because I can just, actually the example I'd have is my phone. Like I can just record a voice note on a bot I have running and just say, hey, I want to automate pushing out these podcast clips or something. Or I want to automate, what's a better example that I can actually see what one I ran today. Let me have a look. I wanted to automate weekly updates to our users. And so what I did there was I held the shortcut button on my phone, which is programmed to do a lot of different things. But one of the things is it kicks off this one of these automation bots I have. And I just said, hey, I want to automate our weekly updates that go to all our users. And that went off and started putting together how this is going to work. And a couple minutes later, about 3-4 minutes later, I got a message on Slack saying, here's the plan. And what that does now is every Friday, it goes and has a look at what engineering did, what they got over the line. It's going to have a look at what our product team had planned. It's going to see what got over the line. It's going to package that all up into a release document and see what needs to go out to users. What is interesting for users? How can they get more value? Not the small behind the scenes stuff. And then it's going to send it to me and it's going to say, hey, do you approve it? Do you disapprove it? Disprove it. Yeah.
I was picking up what you were putting down. I was following.
And what changes do you want? And I just click, yeah, approve or I want changes, and then it's drafted into Custom IO, which is our email marketing system. And that I now know has eliminated an hour of my Friday, or saved an hour of my Fridays, because I never have to do that again now.
Well, and that was just from a single thought of like, hey, you know what? This is what I want to do. Now, I'm assuming that you are the one that has created these bots that make all of that happen for you.
Yeah, but again, that bot had to be created off something. And it was, oh, wait, I make all these automations. I need something to automate the automations. But it definitely started off with, it is so easy to make automations nowadays. It's, you type it into, well, the tool I use, I think, is NAN, but it just does it for you. And I think for me, that's been so critical to keeping on top of everything, because every morning I get a pulse check on all the different industries I'm interested in, but it also can determine if I'm actually interested in it, if it's relevant to me. So it's one thing being subscribed to, say, a marketing feed or something like that.
Yeah. But
it picks up on all the topics that I actually find interesting or would be relevant to, say, the business, or maybe like something to do with marketing in London specifically, or like I'm into aviation, things like that. So the relevance and tying them all together. And that has been so helpful, because I just look at it and I'm like, I have a comment on that. That's really good to know. And within 60 seconds, I've done maybe 90 minutes worth of research, which is something even a year ago, I would have been like, that's not possible, but it is.
That's insane that you are able to do something like that. Well, because now I was thinking, well, one, I was already impressed with the whole voice note and automation thing. I think especially I'm a voracious reader, but I can only keep up with so much. And then I become like, you know, I just have dead eyes, like nothing else is coming in, right? Because it's hard to filter out like what's important. So what you're saying is, in this example, and then I promise we will move on to like the strategy part, but well, I mean, it kind of has to do with like what we're going to talk about in regards to the creator economy and AI, because it shows like really truly the power of AI, and automation is a really great example because it's one of the key things that we can do. So you've got this feed in front of you that helps you from like a research perspective, and you're saying that it learns from what would be the most interesting for you, right? And I'm assuming are you telling it something, or is it picking up on how you're engaging with the content that it's surfacing up?
A bit of both. So it has like a bio on me. It has everything. Like I trained it on, okay, this is who I am. It's what I'm interested in. But then it's also thinking like, are you interested in that? Like, are you actually interested in that? Because one thing I always found is like, don't listen to your audience. Listen to the data that your audience is providing. So like your audience may say they like this, they like that, when in actual fact they like something completely different. And I had that with clients when I was in the ad scene, where they'd be like, oh yeah, no, this is our target market. And I'm like, is it though? The data says otherwise. And they're like, no, but this is our target market. I'm like, okay, look, we'll put a bit of spend to your target market, but let's put the majority of spend towards the data. That's saying your target market is the opposite of this. And the same goes for content strategy. It's like your audience will say they want something when they actually want something else. And that's where I think a lot of creators fall short, is they try to answer their audience or answer what their audience wants when their audience doesn't actually know what they want. So it's a difficult thing to filter out that noise, and was one of the big kind of pillars that we had when we set off with Nevero. It was to level the playing field, but also cut out all the noise that is in marketing.
Yeah. This is a really good segue then. This is a good segue, because now I want to unpack what you just said in regards to that, because I am 100% on board. I think it's in reading in between the lines. This is why I don't like when I'm doing like a voice of customer, or I'm sending out a survey. It's great that people are answering questions, right? Like, what do you like? Do you like green or blue? And then tell me why. They will answer those specific questions, but I always like to get on the line with them and have a conversation, because it's what they say in between the lines. Yeah. that, like, that's actually where the juicy stuff is. Like, yeah. Sure, I got the answer, but that's where the juicy stuff is, which is what I think that you're saying from a similar perspective for, like, the data that you're looking at, informing what the creator should do. So tell me a little bit about, like, what data should I be looking at to understand, like, if I'm a creator, what my community actually wants to be able to see. And we can dive into, like, the vanity metrics, because that's where I think people are going to go straight to, right? Like, views, yeah, likes, shares. That's what I'm looking for, right, Ethan? Or is there something else?
There is. To be honest, I never really look at likes, impressions. I'm trying to think of the top level ones. Comments is where you start, and then it gets juicy from there, I think. What you were saying about reading in between the lines, that is exactly what everyone needs to be doing if they want to really benefit from this kind of era of marketing we're in. But the problem there is sheer volume. Reading in between, like, you can't hop on the call with, if you have, say, 20,000 comments on a post. I'm trying to understand, why did that go viral? What instilled people here to be like, oh, I'm going to comment and express my thoughts on it. And if I could hop on a call with all 20,000, I would, but that would take months. And yes, that's where reading in between the lines, you need a process to allow that to scale. And I know something that we always tried to visualize. We only managed to get it visualized recently, actually, on our landing page, but myself and my co-founder, we'd always describe the social channels and just marketing online as this sea of data, and you've got all these different signals and data points. That's all well and good. And one thing that just could not be visualized is all these different signals, they seem random, but the more you zoom out, but zoom out with the right focus, that's when you start to paint the picture and figure out, okay, this is what my audience wants. And so, to kind of go back to your question about, like, okay, what can I do? Comments is where you start. And if you can aggregate the sentiment, so understand, okay, what are we seeing a lot of, but it's scale, and not really the, I know we get quite a few comments where people are like, oh, come to Brazil. We get, there's a lot of our creators and clients we work with. For some reason, they get a lot of comments saying come to Brazil. But a lot of people do want to, they're trying to get a creator or a brand or an artist to come to wherever they're from. And being able to filter those comments out, but keep that data point that, oh, wait, we're having a lot of people engaged in São Paulo or something like that. Or we're having a lot of people engage in London, but we're seeing that they talk about more, some example here, those London comments, they're seeing, yes, they're saying to come to London, but they're also saying to perform in London. Okay, what can we see from, say, engagement when you had London post? Did people actually attend? And then you can actually start to put a number, a value on, okay, this is the value of a fan in this location with this trait, and start creating this map of, okay, this is actually my audience. And so knowing that, okay, when I post this sort of content in London at this time of the year with this sort of angle or behind the scenes content, this is going to do well, this is actually going to convert, and you have the data to back it. Whilst if we're in Brazil, it's much more about, let's just say, actually showcasing, say, the tourist attractions of Brazil. I'm giving examples here, but
yeah,
knowing exactly what to post and how to angle it becomes a lot clearer when you have the data to tell you exactly what to do.
And you find that this consistently works?
Like, it's not a matter of, oh, will this work on an account? It all comes down to consistency. And it's like, when you have that data to keep you consistent, it's a no-brainer.
So we've been talking and we've mentioned creators a lot. So I think it's really worth clarifying what we're specifically talking about when we talk about that, because, you know, we've got marketers who listen that are very B2B, but what you're talking about isn't necessarily like business to business. You know, business to business tends to use key opinion leaders, and maybe there is a time and a space for it, but you're really speaking about like the creator economy. Is that accurate?
I think it's something that has always kind of fascinated us, in the sense where the creator economy is such a volatile, it's such a liquid industry, in the sense where it changes so much more than any other industry. The backbone that underpins the industry is itself very liquid. Like if you take, I don't know, finance, a very traditional industry, it doesn't change over time. Yes, you have breakthroughs in technology and you have highs and lows and changes in where certain, the economic is that it stays fairly stable when there's ups and downs. Creator economy changes year on year completely. Creators are, in my opinion, actually they are micro enterprises now. They have their audience, they have their IP, and like we work with a lot of social teams, and seeing the use cases that some of those social teams actually use, say some of our tech for, but other tech as well, is just fascinating to see that change over time. Because before, say B2B client we have, they have their marketing team, but then there's also an aspect of every single person that marketing team is a creator at an individual level, but also compounding to actually be the marketing for that brand, or be it external, internal, what they want. But it was really interesting to see how something that was either individual or business has now been merged into both, where everyone has a brand, whether you're vocal about it or not, we all do. And seeing more and more individuals lean in and actually express that brand is where it's go. Well, where we're really seeing it go, but I think it's probably going to go a step further, where that identity you have online is going to become essentially your CV. That's going to be interesting. I think we're going to run into some roadblocks there, but just the way we're mapping our physical identity to our virtual identity, that is changing over time. But I do think overall, and like the end result will be, we get a more realistic representation of people's identity, bar a couple of roadblocks we will run into over the course of that.
I think what's really fascinating about what I'm hearing you say is, and also let me articulate back what I have heard you say to make sure that we're on the same page with that, is that, you know, the creator economy is very fluid in one, that it hasn't been around as long as something like a finance that has a very solid foundation and has a very predictable year over year, this is what we're going to see. But I think the creator economy sits on top of something that also changes and evolves all the time. So like you've got these creators that are also fluctuating on top of that, which has led to creators not just being the people that you kind of see on social, but me sitting in a B2B business now become a creator and representation of the brand that maybe isn't like, you know, this D2C company, but is a B2B, because just by nature of how we're all engaging, we're all individuals of a brand that we represent. And that means something based on like what my social footprint is.
Yeah.
Did I capture that accurately? That
spot on. I think that's like one thing we started off with, which we were, I'm obsessed with personality types. I find it super fascinating. And then we ended up extending out so many different, I guess, personality type classifications to make our own ones. But it was really interesting when we started running so much data on individual brands and seeing the individuals associated with those brands, we could pinpoint their personality type very accurately. But to see the combination of all those individuals representing that brand, to then come up with, this is the personality type of the brand. And then how does that personality type of the brand and the way that's being conveyed externally resonate with the audience, who all have different personality types? Because you think like an ENFP personality type, I'm using Myers-Briggs here, but an ENFP personality type would resonate with an ENFP. But then you find out it doesn't, because that doesn't capture intent. well, before that, doesn't capture attention, which doesn't capture intent.
Yeah.
Because you need that, like a natural, I don't know if you're familiar with pattern interrupts and where that kind of feeds into content. So you've got hooks, those kind of one-liners, the thing that are going to get people to stop. But then you've got pattern interrupts, which is starting a video where I'm putting my glass of water down and it kind of makes the mic spike or something like that. That's an interrupt, something that isn't, it's like a surge in either some, it's like a sensory overload, but so short.
Uh-huh.
You don't know what's going on, but you're like, oh, I'm reframing myself. Oh, I'm reframing mm-hmm. myself on whatever piece of content's in front of me. And so the most natural pattern interrupt we found was to have similar to like a sine wave and having the opposite sine wave to cancel it out. It actually having the polar opposite personality type resonated in the content that you're producing was a pattern interrupt in itself. Following?
No, you lost me a little bit on like how the opposite is. The opposite from a personality perspective is a pattern interrupt. The opposite of like, let's say you and I are in the same company, okay? And we have two different personalities. You're saying those two different personalities are the pattern interrupt. And because of that, what's the outcome? Like it's a...
Yeah. So opposite personality types attract with content.
So interesting.
Every piece of content has, and this is definitely from a scientific perspective.
I'll take the science.
But the personality types, like the say Myers Briggs, that's your one of 16. There's four different aspects to it, but that is the logic that all channels, literally all channels, use to dictate where the content's pushed. So if you can identify where that content, what that personality type is for that content, you know where it's going to be pushed out to. And pushing it out to the direct opposite, the ENFP, and then having like an INFJ, pushing out content that should clash and shouldn't get engagement is weird because it actually does. It is in itself because there's a almost like chalk and cheese. It's kind of like abrasive. It is causing attention to be diverted to it because it's like, oh, what's going on there? And then that's the pattern interrupt, and that's a natural pattern interrupt for content, which is so just like, when we figured this out, we were like, whoa, that's something I did not even realize could be possible from a piece of content.
That is so fascinating because recently I'm running some digital ads, right? And I'm wondering where these digital banners, like where these clicks are coming from, right? I'm from an agency, I'm getting all sorts of impressions and that's really great. But I'm like, where are these ads? Where are they being surfaced? Because I'm really curious because to me, it feeds into the persona that I think that we have. Like, is it on people.com? Is it like, you know, what website is this banner showing? And hopefully I'm not giving anything away like from a company perspective, but like one of the things that I found so interesting is the areas that we're getting the most clicks is in app, in the Solitaire app. Like that just made no sense whatsoever where I was like, wow. And you know, again, I mean, you look at my CV so that you know where it is that I work. It is such an opposite of like what I would think would be. I would have thought it would have been something that was just much more industry related because that's also what I'm surfacing up, right? Like is very industry related, but it was such an opposite, like entertainment and like, here's an ebook. Like the fact that there were people that were clicking to learn more, to find out more. Now, obviously I have a disconnect because I'm not getting as many like leads. So I have to take a look at like where they're going, like what is their intent based on clicking on this?
Yeah.
What do I need to give them to then further like the having them take action once they land there? But I think it's so interesting and it kind of aligns with what you're saying of like these opposites, because I kid you not, I was looking at it and I was like, does this make sense? Does it not make sense? I was just really surprised. And I've literally shared this with a couple of other people where I'm like, solitaire, just didn't see that coming. There were some that were very obvious and I was like, yeah, that makes sense. I could see the connection, but man, the solitaire, that's really
so much sense. Because I think solitaire, when would the majority be of people be playing solitaire? Well, when they haven't got, they've got time on their hands, when they're relaxed, when potentially when they're, say, at home in a comfortable environment, when there's not much pressure externally. So,
and they maybe they are more open to wanting to learn more about something, which I just think, you know, to kind of feed on the point that you had made earlier in regards to like the data informing the content based on the angle and what you should post. This is the thing that I've been noodling over of like, all right, well, how can I use this information to create an ad, an offer or something that gets them closer to where I want them to be based on like the actions that they're taking? You know,
if I was running a campaign that I would take everyone who clicked on it solitaire while playing solitaire, put them into a custom audience, build out a lookalike audience for that custom audience just to get the benefit. But then I would target that custom audience with an offer that is further down the funnel. So pushing them to take a bit more action. But the one thing I'd do is I'd only target when they're on Wi-Fi. Because when you're on Wi-Fi, for me anyways, I'm either going to be at home or I'm going to be in a situation or an environment I'm familiar with, I'm comfortable in. I'm going to be more relaxed. And if you know that when they were playing solitaire, they most likely were in a more relaxed environment where there was less external pressure and they took a form of action. If you hit them with a retargeting ad in a similar situation, that's a pretty, you can be pretty sure you're going to be targeting a good segment of that audience, which is going to be in that state of mind. They're relaxed, Wi-Fi, easiest one to do, and target them with an offer that requires just a bit more of leaning in. And I'd see it's interesting how like our environment obviously affects conversions of ads. But for me, when I'm like right now, I was working away at my desk here, I know that I would be much more likely to go down a rabbit hole for something I didn't know about before. So cold traffic. I would be cold traffic for an app because I'm comfortable in my environment. And that's one simple target, which is target only when I'm Wi-Fi. It's so simple. No one thinks to do it, which is crazy.
No, it's because I think that we get so focused on like these top level metrics. How many impressions did I get? How many clicks did I get? How much lead generation? Whereas I think as a marketer, you need to do that deeper digging to even get to the point in this conversation where we're at of like, oh, the person's more relaxed. I don't think, sometimes I feel like we don't have enough time and space to like breathe and think through like what we should be looking at. And like even identifying what that information tells me, right? And like, what does that mean? What do we do from a content perspective? What can we do from a retargeting perspective? I think that there's no failure in anything you do from a marketing perspective, unless you choose not to learn from it. Like maybe this ad didn't get me like all of the leads that I wanted, but it gave me information. And what can I do with that information, right? Yeah. I think from a social perspective is also really interesting as well too, because I do think that for social, we are very focused on these vanity metrics. And moreover, we're very focused. Well, I've worked with companies that are very focused on this. How can I go viral? Right. And there is this like insane desire for like this viral post, and like this viral post is going to make me so much money. Is there truth behind that, you think? Is there not truth? Can we predict the virality of content?
You can't guarantee virality, but you can engineer shareability.
Tell me about that.
Like, I think like virality is when something goes viral, it's essentially just like showing a piece of content in up or showing that content. They see it as like a mirror. They need to feel like the user or the viewer needs to feel seen. And I think that, well, that's a big part of like how you engineer shareability. And that ties into the vanity metrics, actually. So with vanity, we ignore a lot of metrics. We have our own internal metrics like virality, shareability, relatability. Those are metrics that a lot of people think you can't measure, yet you pull in different sources for metrics. So like if you can use comments and you can use shares, and you can do a bit of a calculation to figure out, okay, that's a pretty good representation of is something actually shareable. And when you have those metrics, you're just optimizing for those three metrics: virality, shareability, and relatability. Shareability is the easiest one to quantify. Relatability is definitely down to the actual content you're posting, but those two combine to give you your virality score. And that's something we use internally because it's just so valuable to see, okay, that score's good, that score's bad, that score's good. Okay, something's going wrong here. We know that's content related. What's going on there? Shareability is probably to do with the copy you've got on an ad, on a post, but like how you're actually taking that attention and fostering it into intent and that intent into action. And all those three, it is a bit of a balancing act with virality. But I would be, I'm always for shareability over virality, because virality doesn't necessarily mean you're going to actually make a lot of conversions, or you're going to, that you're going to convert customers. I remember when TikTok ads started skyrocket, like taking off, you could get quite literally a video with 1 million+ views, and the conversion rate is just astronomically low. And it's, well, it's great. You're getting your shareability. You're getting your relatability, but that, and you're getting your virality as well. But that's when your funnel comes into play with, okay, you're capturing attention. You may be getting the right intent, but your intent to action is wrong. That's the break in that flow. And so, yeah, it's a balancing act. There's a lot of different factors, but I know a lot of people get cloudy vision by all the other vanity metrics, hyperfixating on, oh, impressions means attention, or likes means attention, or video views, 20%, 25% video views means that's capturing attention, but it's not keeping them there long enough to foster intent or action. But that's the problem. It's like, don't get so bogged down by those very surface level metrics and try take, okay, I know X percent commented. Let's figure out the liked comment ratio. That's a much better indicator of, okay, how well did I capture attention versus intent? Because if people are putting the time into actually commenting onto your post, expressing whatever thoughts they have, negative or positive, but versus the people who scrolled and liked versus the people who just scrolled. Those ratios give you a much better interpretation of how well that did from where the breakdown was from the performance of that post, because it maps perfectly onto attention, intent, action.
My armchair theory is that people are so focused on vanity metrics because they're easy for leadership to understand what that means. And I don't think that what we have at our fingertips is that next level that you're talking about, right? Like, it's that, what does this mean? I find that I always have to explain, I have to be choosy with what I am surfacing. Yeah. And then I have to tell them why it's important. And then all right, what then? Right? Like, what do I do then with this information? Right? So I think vanity metrics gets so much attention because it's the sexy stuff at the top, right? Like, it's the things that people don't have to think about. They see it everywhere. So like, that should be super approachable. I don't know if you have advice on how you can like educate people to the next level of like, all right, well, yeah, we got this amount of views and likes and whatnot, but what's really important is this, and this is why, and then what? I don't know if you have advice for that.
Relating it to money. Unfortunately, that's the way to do it.
That is always the key is relating it back to money. If I can put anything with dollars, it's like a straight line of now I've got your attention.
That's what we did. Like, I remember when we had a client, and I remember one day I was like, you guys have all these systems, you have them, you can just read the data. And they're like, no, Ethan, we don't pay you to show us this data. We pay you to tell us what this data means.
Yes. And
that's when it was like some switch flicked in my head, and I was like, oh, I'll just build something that you can then understand the data. And so I was like, well, I can take all this data and then regurgitate numbers that actually will be understood by finance, will be understood by C-suite, things like that. And I made a funnel. It still is running today, but input output, that's at the end of the day, that's what every C-suite or managerial position cares about, is like what went in and what came out.
Exactly.
And it always has to relate back to the constant that is across an entire business, which is money. It is revenue. Yeah. It's how much did we spend. It's profit versus loss.
It
became so much easier to get like managers on board with certain campaigns when I was able to show them, we spent this, this is how much was generated, and these are the metrics in the middle that matter. Because what happens now is a lot of marketing campaigns, it's difficult to know what the output is. Pretty easy to make a guess on the input, but if you can say the input, we spent X amount of dollars and all that we've gotten out of it is impressions, likes, comments, that's where there's a bit of a breakdown in, well, understanding, okay, what is the value of that? Because you're missing the output at the bottom. And then begs the question, okay, what if you can't monitor or quantify what that output is? Like, it's content, it's organic marketing, let's say. It's difficult to quantify it. And that's where AI came in, where that was impossible up until 3 years ago. Because it all was qualitative. It was like, okay, we got this, we have this marketing budget, we've done XYZ campaign, we know we've got these amount of impressions, likes, comments, shares, followers. What does that translate to in terms of revenue? But with AI, you can turn that qualitative data into quantitative data, because with all those different data points and metrics and signals, you can now, well, produce a number, which is the lifetime value of a fan.
Yeah. I just want that tool that gives me that number so that I can quantify it. Because I'm a total data dork. I love it. I think that numbers tell a story, and I have to be a master at storytelling as a marketer to be able to articulate that. And this is the part where this is why I love AI as well too, which is why I'm so obsessed with like hacking it. You take it to a whole other level, which now I just want to be in your brain so that I can figure out how to do those things as well too. But like, it is so that you can be a better storyteller of the information that you're seeing, because there's so many different levels, and being able to equate it to the dollars is so key for honestly keeping marketing alive, I feel like, at any company, because we're the first ones to be cut if we can't show like, hey, we are bringing something to the table, and because you need to make a business impact. You know, I'm more than just a fancy logo and a bumper sticker. You know, like, we're actually doing something that helps move the needle. So I think like what AI can do for marketing is we're just scratching the surface, and there's so much more that will be able to be done. And I, for one, am not one of these people that worry about AI taking over my job. I think this is why you have to hack it, right? Yeah. You have to be like, all right, how can I use this to do more with less, and like, you know, burn your calories where like the brain power should be.
Exactly.
But I could talk to you for hours about this for sure, but I've got one final question so that we can wrap up the podcast. And that is, if you knew then what you know now, what is the marketing or non-marketing advice that you would give to yourself?
Track everything. I think that was something I did not do sooner, in the sense where in the last 6 months, I've moved from not tracking Well, tracking a good bit to do with marketing to tracking absolutely everything. And it has changed everything, not just from a marketing perspective, from how I go about my day to day, how I go about organizing meetings, how I go about with hobbies, with social events, things like that. The example I give is I have an Oura ring. And a lot of people think, oh, it just tells your sleep, it tells your readiness data. And what happens every Sunday is I will get a report, a biocheck report, I just called it. And it pulls all the data from that ring, all the data from my phone, all the data from the smart home, all the data from a calendar, figures out exactly what I ended up doing for the week and figures out where I went wrong. Like, did I sleep too late? Like, I'm definitely going to get an alert for not wearing. So I have these blue light glasses. It's going to know I didn't wear these. And it's going to tell me like, hey, this is how you affected. Your performance dropped when you're exercising tomorrow. I definitely know I'm going to get given out to for that. But
you're predicting your readout.
That's funny. And it all came from just tracking everything, because I think a lot of people think that tracking everything requires a lot of effort.
Yeah,
it is. It doesn't require any anymore. And planning with that mentality as if you're doing something and, oh yeah, it's going to be quite tedious. It's like, well, the rate of which AI and all this tech is progressing in 6 months' time, it's not going to be difficult. So you need to plan for it not being difficult.
That's so smart. And it makes sense that that would be your advice as it is, because I don't know if you remember from when we started, you said you're a patterns guy. So you can only detect patterns if you have all of the data points, whether it comes from marketing or like for your personal life as well too, to really like, you're looking for efficiency in all areas. And I really like that. This was an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for just sharing your insights, and you definitely have me looking at things differently.
I'm glad to. It was honestly such a good conversation. I honestly could talk about hours about automation and just AI. So it's definitely nerd out with it. But no, thank you so much for having me on. It's been great.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Welcome back. I am ready for the key takeaways. Are you? Key takeaway number one, metrics mirror lie, also known as vanity metrics. Let's be honest, vanity metrics are seductive. Views, likes, impressions, they feel good. They look good in a slide deck, and they're easy to point to when someone from leadership asks, how's marketing doing? But as Ethan reminded us, they're not the whole story. And in fact, they can be dangerously misleading. He went so far to share that he doesn't even really look at likes and impressions. Oh, I know, right? For him, it is all about the comments. That is where to get started, and I couldn't agree more. Now, why is that? Great question. Because comments reveal intent. They reflect someone taking the time to engage, not just react. And in those comments, especially at scale, you'll see the between the lines truth, how people feel, what they really care about, and what moved them to really speak up and comment. He even explained how his AI tools aggregate the sentiment to guide content decisions and really identify where true engagement is happening far beyond these surface level stats. There is a way to do this without AI, but I'll be honest, it's time consuming. If you get a ton of comments, more in reach if you don't, but sadly, you want more. Maybe a podcast on how to evaluate that information in the comments section is warranted. I will put a pin on that one for now. Getting back to the subject at hand, what else is wrong with those vanity metrics? Here's the real kicker with them. Those likes and views might not even come from your ideal audience. When you follow the trail of engagement, not attention, you can find the insights that can flip an entire campaign strategy on its head. So challenge yourself. Next time you check your campaign metrics, don't just celebrate the high numbers. Ask what's underneath them. Look at the comments. Are people tagging friends? Are they asking questions? Are they emotionally reacting in more than just an emoji? That's where the real marketing intel lives. Not in the mirror of metrics, but in the message behind them. Key takeaway number two, opposites distract, and that's a good thing. One of the most unexpected insights was Ethan kind of talking personality types. And now my new favorite term, pattern interrupts, which is basically that creative twist that stops the thumb scroll, right? But Ethan took it to a whole new level. He explained that opposites, the example we dove into was personality, can actually create more powerful pattern interrupt than flashy visuals or bold headlines. When your content shows up with a tone and a style or a personality that kind of clashes a little bit with what your audience expects, that friction is what gets attention. It interrupts the brain's kind of autopilot. And in a digital world overflowing with sameness, that disruption is gold. I am sure you're all familiar with the Myers-Briggs personality types. Now, not to get too into the weeds, but in Ethan's example during the episode, he used ENFP content shown to INTJs. And for those of you who don't know these personality types quickly, I want you to think, let's explore new ideas together person against a give me the insight, give me the data, and don't waste my time. It sounds completely counterintuitive, right? But that psychological contrast becomes the hook. That, wait, this isn't my usual vibe moment makes people stop, reorient, and then tune in. He even likened it to the sine wave. When one frequency meets its opposite, it doesn't cancel it out. It creates resonance. Here's the lesson. Not all content should be comfortable. Sometimes the best way to capture attention is to be intentionally different. So embrace contrast, disrupt the feed, and use personality, not just polish, as a strategic advantage. Because in this sea of sameness, difference isn't a risk. It is going to be your best asset. My final key takeaway number three, go for the share, not the spotlight. We've all been tempted by the siren song of virality, the spotlight. That dream of a post just blowing up overnight, riding the algorithm wave, and then launching our brand into spotlight. But the truth is, while you can't engineer virality, according to Ethan, you can engineer shareability. So let's unpack that. Virality is unpredictable. It's lightning in a bottle. But shareability, that's something that we can build towards with intention. Shareability comes when people feel seen, when the content mirrors something personal, and they want to actually send it to someone else. Virality is the outcome, but shareability and relatability are the ingredients. And here's the good news. Those ingredients are measurable. Ethan's team builds internal metrics around these kind of three dimensions, these ingredients, scoring content for its potential to be shared and felt, not just clicked. And what I loved was kind of just his clarity on this. Content that gets shared does more than just perform. It connects. And connection leads to trust. And trust is what fuels conversion. So instead of chasing that algorithm, chase alignment. Create things that are worth passing on, things that make someone say, this is so me, or I thought of you immediately. Because at the end of the day, you don't need to go viral. You don't need to go viral at all. You know what you need? You need to go valuable. And valuable spreads a lot further than views. And that's my final take on today's episode. If you took away a nugget of insight, a great way to show your into what you're listening to is to give us a follow and write a review. It really does help us out. A very special thank you to my podcast editor, Johnny Ike, and thanks most of all for you for spending your time with me today. Until next time, may the conversation flow, the laughter linger, and the outlook remain optimistic but grounded in reality. This is Katya, signing off.